It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to your program suggestions, we dive into questions about Medicare health plans and how to navigate coverage and costs. We heard from Julia in Madison, who wants to elevate a Wisconsin resource called the Medigap Helpline for
all individuals in Wisconsin that are trying to decipher through the Medicare, you know, all the choices to be made.
Join the conversation about federal health insurance. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sadie Tischer is owner and an independent broker with Wisconsin Health Insurance Advocate, LLC. Sadie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate.
Well, let's begin with prescriptions. Price negotiations with drug makers will soon begin for 10 drugs covered under Medicare. What should people understand about the federal government's price review process?
Well, there's a lot to understand, but in a nutshell, long term, we're really hoping this will equate to savings, especially for prescriptions that are essential, life-saving, and don't have an alternative. So the federal government has decided to focus on prescriptions in certain classes and drugs that don't have a viable generic alternative. Brand names are incredibly expensive under the Medicare Part D program. So this is exciting news. Beneficiaries really shouldn't expect very immediate relief. Most of the negotiation is sort of a slow ramp up, and we're going to see it really start going underway in 2026. But I'm really hopeful that it will help.
Part D of Medicare provides that prescription drug coverage. Are you surprised by any of the 10 drugs selected by the federal government?
No, I'm not surprised. They are expensive medications and they're relatively common. So I think it will be helpful to folks.
You said 2026. When will people see some relief on drug costs?
Well, we're seeing some slight relief this year in that the Medicare Part D program's catastrophic phase now actually has a cap this year. For 2024, it's going to be capped at $8,000 worth of prescription drug spending. That is still a very high amount, but in years past, in 2023 included, that number had no cap. There was no cap on prescription drug spending for beneficiaries. People are going to see the biggest impact in 2025 when there is a $2,000 cap or out-of-pocket maximum, essentially, on prescription drug pricing. So we'll see some slight changes for 2024, but the major changes are going to happen in 2025 and beyond.
According to Medicare, most plans have a coverage gap that is sometimes called the donut hole. That's a, you know, the temporary limit on what a drug plan will cover. How can someone avoid the donut hole coverage gap?
So when you are doing a review for your prescription drug plan, whether that's within a Medicare Advantage plan or just a standalone drug plan, you want to do that during open enrollment and search based on your specific drugs and your preferred pharmacy. Sometimes that does mean you need to, or it might be suggested that you change plans so you get your best pricing. Generally speaking, my best advice is if there is a commercial for a prescription, that is a very expensive prescription and you are likely to fall into the donut hole. So I think the best preventive advice I can give is when you're at your doctor's office and they're suggesting a prescription, ask if there's a generic available.
We're talking with Sadie Tischer, who is helping us through Medicare open enrollment period, Wisconsin health insurance broker in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Sadie, COVID-19 no longer considered a national emergency by the federal government. And as a result, the Medicaid continuous enrollment condition ended earlier this year. How is the removal of the enrollment condition affecting people?
So now through next year, people are going to have a review. During the public health emergency, reviews were paused. So many people who otherwise might have lost Medicaid were able to stay on. So we're basically just seeing those people now going off of Medicaid. For the most part, those are people who had lower incomes during the pandemic, and then their income has since changed. So we're seeing a lot of movement with people losing Medicaid.
With a lot of movement, who is most at risk for losing Medicaid coverage this year?
Anyone whose income has changed significantly, if they've got a different job, if they have all of a sudden some savings. I know a lot of people took advantage of the extra unemployment benefits, and so they have savings sometimes now beyond the limits. So anyone whose income has changed since they first applied, that those are the people who are losing it now.
And more than 240,000 Wisconsinites left Medicaid coverage as of October 23rd, and that's analysis by KFF. That's an independent health research organization. What healthcare options are available to people losing Medicaid coverage this year?
So for people under the age of 65 or who aren't eligible for Medicare, they can go into the Affordable Care Act, healthcare.gov marketplace, and many of those people are eligible for subsidies. It certainly is going to be more expensive for them than Medicaid, which is very low cost for people. And then for people who are eligible for Medicare, they essentially are needing, for the most part, to switch their Medicare plan. Many beneficiaries who are Medicare and Medicaid have a combo called a dual needs plan, which they're great plans, but people are needing to switch out of those then, or they lose the benefits.
How much help is there to do this? Where do people seek navigation help and you know, trying to figure out where to go from here with their plans?
So I am perhaps somewhat biased because I'm an independent agent, but I can always recommend, you know, find a local independent agent or broker, ideally someone who represents a whole bunch of plans, not just one or one company, so that they can really do a comparison shop for you. There is also, as mentioned at the top of the hour with the call-in, there's the Medigap Helpline, which is the state health insurance program, and that is run through the state of Wisconsin. So the folks there actually do have independent agent licenses, but they are paid through the state instead of commissions through insurance companies. So both of those are good options, especially for local assistance. The plans are unique to Wisconsin. So sometimes calling a 1-800 number with call centers throughout the country, they don't really understand the networks or what the different providers are. So those are both good resources. There's definitely a local agent where you live.
And really understanding the local system and the local networks is important. You know, Medicaid.gov says more than 650,000 Wisconsin children are in Medicaid's Children Health Insurance Program, CHIP. Are children eligible for the program if parents become ineligible for Medicaid?
Yes. So criteria for adults and children was separated out in Wisconsin Medicaid program when Badger Care was only slightly expanded back in 2010 with the Affordable Care Act. We didn't fully expand, but yes, there are plenty of families where the children are still on Badger Care. Children are eligible up to 300% of the federal poverty level. Adults are only eligible up to 100% of the federal poverty level.
Sadie Tischer is a health insurance broker in southeastern Wisconsin. You can be part of this conversation about health insurance at any point. Call in with a question. You can add your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Open enrollment for Medicare is underway. We dig into your questions about comparing plans and coverage. Thanks to Artie and Tom in Madison, Mary in Park Falls for encouraging a discussion about Medicare coverage. And you can be part of it. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sadie Tischer is an independent insurance broker in southeastern Wisconsin. Sadie, you say the biggest questions that you get from clients is about the capping out-of-pocket drug costs with Medicare. What should people know about maximum costs?
I think the best thing they can know is that, you know, there's relief coming, which is fantastic. Thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, that's what's going to happen in 2025. There's going to be a $2,000 cap. $2,000 might sound like a large amount, but it, with what we're dealing with, it is a pretty small amount. I did a search for a client a couple of weeks ago, and her out-of-pocket costs were well over $10,000. So, and that's not all that irregular in the Medicare prescription drug benefit, especially if someone needs brand name drugs. There are certain drugs that a person does need to take a brand name for medical reasons, or there's not a viable generic for them. So it really is going to have a huge impact. It was really exciting part of the Inflation Reduction Act. The Inflation Reduction Act, as we kind of talked about in the first half too, there's going to be some negotiation by Medicare of drug pricing, and there's going to be penalties for the drug manufacturers if they refuse to negotiate too. So it's a good first attempt, I think, for the federal government to put some caps on the absolutely exponential cost of prescription drugs that we have just seen over the last really for several decades, but it just continues to grow exponentially in cost. There's been no control on the pricing of drugs, and that can really affect seniors because the Medicare drug program, specifically the 2003 Medicare Modernization Act, prohibited the federal government from negotiating prices. So that really hurt. It just let drug companies set whatever prices they want for prescriptions.
So if you choose a private plan instead of like original Medicare, like a private plan in like Part C, do Medicare Advantage plans have out-of-pocket limits?
They do for medical. So the prescription drug portion of a Medicare Advantage plan, if it has drug coverage, is sort of separate. It's combined within the plan, but the drug costs are actually counted separately. And that $8,000 max that I had mentioned earlier, that does apply to Medicare Advantage plans as well.
Okay. And, you know, how should you go about comparing these all-in-one Medicare Advantage plans versus like buying a standalone Part D Medicare plan that gives you the prescription drug coverage?
I think it really depends on your personal needs. Medicare Advantage plans can be really great. They offer a lot of extra benefits. They have a cap on health costs. That can be great. They have most of them have some sort of dental or vision. Some of the benefits are quite generous on that. And then people with original Medicare and a Part D plan often have a supplement plan instead of a Medicare Advantage plan. So it's sort of different needs for different people. I'd really recommend you talk to a professional, like a local broker, the state health insurance program, that Medigap helpline. Get some local help from someone who does this every day. Medicare is extremely complicated. Our jobs are to know it every day. Like, we are experts in this field. So there's a lot of help available.
Let's go to Craig in Gays Mills. Craig, hi. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. An additional resource to what you've already mentioned for people trying to sort out their options where they particularly live would be your county's Aging and Disability Resource Center, the ADRCs, in each county in Wisconsin.
Craig, do you have a personal connection, or have you worked through an ADRC before?
Well, yes, both. I have personally used our ADRC here in Crawford County and got very good help with one of the staff persons there in making my own choices about Medicare. And I also serve on the board of both our county board and also on the ADRC committee here, so I'm familiar with what we can offer here in Crawford County, but ADRCs are in every county in Wisconsin as well.
Well, thank you so much for bringing this resource to the conversation. Appreciate it, Craig. And Sadie, just noting there that there is help, especially in, you know, county by county help for aging and disability resource centers.
Yes, and I myself actually came out of the Milwaukee County ADRC. I was a disability benefit specialist there myself. So that's actually what I used to do before this. Yes.
that hits close to home. So, Artie of Madison recently called into our show and said there's a lot of misinformation out there on Medicare and Medicaid. What is often misunderstood about these programs?
There's a lot that's misunderstood. I think for me, the most frustrating thing is the commercials, particularly Medicare Advantage commercials. I don't want to say that they're misleading, but they only highlight certain benefits.
$0 premiums, free exercise classes, preloaded debit cards. Can I keep going?
Exactly. And thank you. That is actually a really good point, Kate. So that is probably my biggest frustration is the preloaded debit cards or help with utility bills or groceries. Those are all dual needs plans for people who are eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. And what is so frustrating to me, this happens in calls too. It's not just commercials. There's a lot of unsolicited calls from call centers going on. They start with telling you that benefit. They find out inevitably you're not eligible for Medicaid because the people who are, like, that's a relatively narrow population. And then they already have you on the phone, and now they're going to kind of bait and switch you into switching into a different plan. Now you haven't gotten local help. The number of people that I have spoken to that have originally picked a plan or got a call from some representative somewhere out there, switched them into a plan that then didn't cover their doctors or their local hospital or this medication that they need. That's why I really encourage some sort of local help, whether that's through a broker, the SHIP program, the Medigap program, they're kind of interchangeable terms, your local ADRC, if they're able to provide that service, some sort of local help that can walk you through those plans rather than picking up the call.
We're talking with Sadie Tischer, who is an independent health insurance broker in southeastern Wisconsin. With Medicare open enrollment underway, answering your questions at 800-642-1234. Sadie, you mentioned earlier about supplements, Medicare supplement plans, and I think it's called Medigap. What should we know there when a supplement is needed?
So those are interchangeable terms. Yeah, we can either call them a supplement plan or a Medigap plan. Medigap plans, in my opinion, are really good for people who have higher medical needs. And that's because they essentially cover more, but you pay for it in a monthly premium. Medicare supplement plans were not touched by the Affordable Care Act, so they do underwrite for medical conditions. You get a 6-month guaranteed issue when you first turn 65 or you're first eligible for Medicare Part A and B. So whenever you start that, whether it's before 65 or after because you've delayed for work. So during that period, you can go into any Medicare supplement plan without underwriting. After that period, there are very few scenarios. There are a couple, but very few scenarios in which you can switch over to a supplement plan. So my advice is if you think you're going to need one, get it early.
Okay. Carol now in Northern Illinois. Carol, what is your question?
Good morning. This is more like, what have you got for us? Because we've had the Medicare for 5 years. I never got the drug plan. And it's not that I blew it off because I have notes and stuff, and I'm not on any medication. And in order to pick the plan, because they're all independent, I'm in Illinois, not Wisconsin, but, it is a national program. So I'm at that point where I'm pretty sure I'm going to keep my Medigap because it seems like it pays for a lot. I haven't had a problem there, but the drug plan, I'm trying to work with the SHIP lady, the aging, they help with those plans. And and she's like, educate yourself. And I this sounds like me, but I don't know where to go because they're, you pay, like she said, get the cheapest per month. And I said, because I have a friend that might have breast cancer, and those are the expensive drugs with all that donut hole and all that stuff.
Carol, I want to pause there. Sadie, go ahead on trying to navigate Part D, the prescription drug coverage, if you haven't had it before.
Yeah, so I would recommend you talk to a local broker, someone who works with multiple plans, and have them do a comparison shop and educate you a bit on that, because you're right, like it's complex information. That being said, if you don't take any prescriptions currently, I tend to recommend just an inexpensive plan. Reason being, all prescription drug plans have to cover drugs in each of the Medicare categories. So each plan does have drugs in a category. What we want to look at, maybe a different or more expensive plan, is when people have specific drugs that we want to look at. So it's difficult to prepare yourself for any eventuality. Just keep in mind, too, you get to switch plans every year. So if you're worried about worst case scenario, you can always switch for the following year. But every drug plan covers drugs within each category. It just might have a higher deductible.
Sadie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Kate.
Sadie Tischer, owner and an independent broker at Wisconsin Health Insurance Advocate. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the future of the hemp crop in Wisconsin, its markets and uses. Now, girls' interest in computing, it peaks in middle school, according to a study from Girls Who Code. If they participate in computing classes and programs at that age, they're more likely to continue their interest through the rest of their education. Margaret Faust reports Milwaukee School of Engineering and Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Southeast collaborate each year to increase interest in science, technology, engineering, and math.
A group of fourth and fifth grade girls get robots and a laptop. Their goal is to explore what a robot can do and then execute a routine for it to perform. In the Milwaukee School of Engineering STEM Center, the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin Southeast play around with the sound effects they could code into their robots. Across the table, 10-year-old Vi Michaels is focused. She's wearing her green Girl Scout vest, which is decorated with the badges she's earned. Her brown curly hair frames her face. She's named her robot Popo. She's planned out 3 moves for it to do. After some tinkering, it can move forward and turn in circles. But when it's supposed to meow like a cat, nothing happens. She turns to the laptop and the code is gone.
Something happened to our code and it like changed.
Even though Popo didn't quite behave the way she wanted, Vi says she still had a lot of fun.
We had a lot of other stuff in it that didn't work. It's fine. Popo was amazing.
Liz Taylor is the director of STEM at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. She says girls and boys of the same age tend to have the same ability at science, technology, engineering, and math, but girls don't always see it.
But their confidence and like self-visualization of their success in those areas tends to differ greatly with young girls, especially feeling like maybe they're not capable of those topics.
She says exposure to STEM early and often can make a difference. A Microsoft study found that girls who do STEM outside of school are more likely to stick with it. But according to the Society of Women Engineers, only 29% of the STEM workforce are women. Barriers include gender stereotypes and male-dominated culture. Jordan Sievert is a biomedical engineering major and volunteered at the event. As a woman in her field, she sometimes feels underestimated.
People don't necessarily expect me to get a full grasp on every challenge thrown my way, but that makes it even more exciting to prove that I can do this just as well and sometimes better than everybody else.
She doesn't want these Girl Scouts to face the same adversity.
I want them to feel empowered and just tackle every challenge head on and that get that confidence that they deserve to have.
Fellow Girl Scout Embry DeGratz faced some challenges while coding her robot. Like Vi, her robot speakers weren't working, and she couldn't get it to make a sound. But she says she isn't discouraged.
You come across lots of problems in your life, but for me, I always try and get back up from it. If I can't, that's a sign to me that this is too hard. Let's try again when I'm a little bit better at it.
It took Vi time to build up her skills. She has advice for younger girls to get started.
Before getting into the big stuff, like focus on the smaller stuff that is already made for you that you can work on yourself.
When a visitor at the event asked, asked if they wanted to give robotics another try, the Girl Scouts had a unanimous response.
Yes.
Vi and her troop mates earned a programming robot badge for their work. Now it can be ironed on to their green Girl Scout vests. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to Mario in Ashland, we check in on hemp production in Wisconsin. During a color-only program, Mario asked, what holds back this crop?
My understanding is hemp is a very viable, versatile product as far as clothing, paper, oil, etc. And I know they grow a lot of it in Canada.
Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alex Mutz is a hemp farmer in Adams, Wisconsin, and president of Complete Agronomy, LLC. Alex, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Like, so, some historical context here. Between World War I and World War II, Wisconsin leads, you know, hemp production in the nation. And today, Canada is the world's top producer, according to Statistica. Why is so much hemp produced in Canada?
Well, first of all, I think the climate of that, there's a lot to unpack there. But the way that they grow there, they're a major producer of hemp grain, obviously, and fiber. Flour is a big part of it, too. But, you know, the biggest reason, in my opinion, is, you know, all the products that hemp, whether it be hemp oil, hemp grain for, you know, protein or anything like that, there's always byproducts, right? So say you're making a hemp oil and you're going to go compete into the seed oil market, your byproduct being the hulls and shells or what was referred to as cake, can't be monetized in the traditional sense here in the U.S. For example, we can't sell that to the cattle market for feed because the regulators in charge of that won't allow that to happen. So which makes the product on the shelf more expensive, right? Because they can't monetize the downstream stuff. So that's just one example, but a lot of it just has to do with time. It's still, I mean, this stuff was been banned basically since, you know, the late 30s. So infrastructure, technology advancements, farming tactics, all of those things play a role in why hemp is having a slower start here in the U.S. than what everyone would like to see.
So what I hear from you is Canada has more favorable, established, value-added markets for hemp and all of its different products it could go into.
Yeah, correct. Even down from, you know, I heard the question that was aired before me and you started talking about, you know, it's a great fiber for spinnable textiles, all that stuff. But, you know, none of those textile plants or anything that's actually even made here in the U.S. are not built to intake hemp anymore. I mean, it wasn't a viable raw material option for many, 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 many years. So all the advancements made in every sector and all the verticals created to the end consumer to minimize cost centers and all of those things, it's a much steeper mountain to climb than I think a lot of people are expecting. And it behooves the people that have control over those industries not to allow it to come in. So, yeah.
Well, let's look at some of the scaffolding here. The 2018 Farm Bill programs expired last month. Others will expire at the end of the year. What changes are you advocating for in the next Farm Bill by Congress that provides assistance to hemp farmers?
You know, the biggest thing is from the farming on the ground level is, you know, the requirements for large grain or fiber production. You know, I advocate for that really should not be treated the same as, you know, a flower production meant for the CBD or cannabinoid space. Reason being is, you know, we have to follow the same rules as a farmer growing, say, 2,000 plants And I'm growing, say, 300 acres of fiber, you know, with over 1 million plants an acre. I hate to see those testers have to walk out there through that jungle to test it. So there needs to be a separation of those two streams from hemp, although they're from the same plant. They couldn't be any more different as far as their end product goal. So that's one of the biggest ones I advocate for. The other one is the increase from the THC threshold from 0.3% to 1%. You're seeing those types of things be enacted over in the EU. And I don't know if Canada is at 1% or not, but the reason for that is, you know, they set the 0.3 threshold as a maximum amount of THC a cannabinoid plant can have with all different cannabinoids in it that aren't psychoactive. Mm-hmm. Delta 9 being the psychoactive one, that's a schedule one still. It needs to be increased to at least a 1% because after harvest and after the testing, during the end process to get it to that oil, concentration happens. And with concentration comes gray areas that a lot of farmers are stuck with, oils and other products that was produced from their flower grows that they can't really ship federally because of the fact that it has more than 0.3%, right? But really, it's an in-process material that was already deemed compliant by the USDA.
Okay, so THC, the chemical in marijuana that produces a high, what happens if a hemp field contains more than 0.3% THC?
So there are remediation programs that the USDA offers in those situations. It can be quite devastating to a farmer. I know plenty of farmers throughout the U.S. that have had to basically turn over their crop and just get down. And
has that happened to you?
No, it has not. No, but it can. I mean, it's as simple as buying a genetic, and you know, there's a lot of things that can happen in the field. Stress can cause a higher production. The plant's response would be to, in a stressful situation, it could be to increase production of THC. So there's all sorts of situations. That's why it's really important if you're going to grow for flower, that's a much more focused and labor intensive, and really have to pay attention to that crop. Whereas fiber and grain, which is what actually, in my opinion, could be a third rotational crop option in the U.S., is not nearly as finicky in regards to that because you're creating grain. The plant is focusing its energy to create grain, not cannabinoids.
Okay, so in 2017, Wisconsin starts its industrial hemp pilot program, and then the program went mm-hmm. under the U.S. Department of Agriculture's control last year. Is this transition to federal oversight affecting production at your farm?
Not the rules basically stayed the same. I mean, the Wisconsin hemp pilot program mirrored what the USDA was doing pretty well. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, we've seen, I think it's something like a 90% decrease in hemp licenses, even in Wisconsin. So there really
isn't
much of a
90% decrease.
Oh yeah.
Why?
Oh yeah.
What's going on?
Well, the markets aren't there, not there yet. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. And the biggest problem with it was the overproduction in 19. You know, we did somewhere, I think it was over 100,000 acres in the U.S. And we didn't know how much flower was being produced, how much grain was being produced, because at that time, the data wasn't being segregated and shared in that sense. So there was really kind of a shot in the dark. You know, you had very, very high prices in 2018 on the flower market, and then a steep decline and crash in 19 because of the overproduction. At the same time, the fiber industry or the fiber crop to be used as like a paper or softwood replacement, it's just going to take time to penetrate even the building codes. I mean, you know, just to use it as an insulation or a flooring or, you know, anything, it has to go through a pretty strict regulatory process to get to even the level that we can sell and safely install in homes. So all those systems and verticals have to be built. Meanwhile, you're competing against raw material production paper mills and et cetera that have had basically no competition and able to set up these verticals for, you know, a generation or two. So, yeah, it's just it doesn't mean that there's no hope. It's we're seeing great success, and we have partnered with people, and we just keep going further down the supply chain and take it upon ourselves to try to get to the customer and show them how awesome of a product this is, not only for its uses, but also for what it does to our soil and how healthy it is for everything.
Alex Mutz is a hemp farmer in Adams, Wisconsin. You can be part of this discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your perspectives. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the outlook for Wisconsin's hemp crop, thanks to Mario and Ashland for this topic suggestion. As the U.S. Department of Agriculture oversees the different forms and qualities of hemp, provides regulatory oversight of hemp production nationwide, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alex Mutz is a hemp farmer in Adams. Alex, how is your crop looking amid the fall harvest season?
You know, good. This morning and yesterday morning, woke up in a bit of a panic. I kind of forgot what rain was there, but had a bunch of bales that we brought out, some fiber bales, and had to scurry to get those covered. But we hit all of our benchmarks and improvements that we wanted to make this year on the fiber and on the fiber side, and had some really good success with some new weed management tactics we were using and soil prep. And, you know, every year is just, you learn a little bit more and you did a little bit better at it. I'm a first generational farmer. So, I have a lot of close farmers around me as mentors to help me along this and make sure I'm not trying to solve a problem that's already been solved. But, it's looking good.
What problems come up for you so far with, like, diseases and insects and keeping down the weeds?
So the weeds, a lot of that has to do with getting your canopy up, trying to get them popped out of the ground faster. Depth is a very, very important part and crucial part of this whole thing. And then, you know, whatever is people say about this plant not needing the water during those early days and early weeks, water is obviously very important. So, we did everything under pivot to get rid of that variable and, had a really good season. As far as bug pressure, it really just depends. We've got, sometimes you'll find, you know, we've got some boar worm out there every once in a while. This year for pests, you know, I think mostly maybe because it was so dry, but we really didn't have very much pest pressure at all. So we were really lucky this year, but there's not a lot of tools in our chest that, for instance, like if you were a corn grower or a soybean grower, there's not a lot of tools the hemp industry has to fight against those. One, because, you know, we may not be growing on organic land, but we're trying to grow organically with mm-hmm. this, trying not to cause any more harm than needed. So, but the plant is resilient, and there's a reason why it's it kind of grows almost anywhere. It's pretty resilient to a lot of those pressures. So
the USDA delaying enforcement of testing hemp crops through a U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency lab, and that's going to be delayed through the end of the year. How does that affect Wisconsin hemp farmers?
So, well, I only pick, it's just easier and better for everyone. I mean, obviously the intention for the DEA and the USDA is to make sure that we're getting tests done by third-party labs that have passed a strict, basically, licensing and application history, all of that stuff. And, you know, I like to make sure to test with those types of organizations because I know that those regulations cause a lot of stress and cost to get mm-hmm. that. So in a way, if they're going to do it, they need to do it so that the testing part of this industry can really, you know, blossom into what it's meant to be, which is a third party, government regulated, backed authority that says, hey, this I know is hemp grain. I know this is hemp flour. And here's the tests that prove it. Here's where I went in the field by geolocation. So I like the idea of it. I think that there's a lot of problems created by testing facilities that are either, you know, they're popular because they're telling the farmer what they want to hear as far as purity and potency, and instead of being an unbiased opinion where the test is what the test is by the same standard that's been set across the country. So I love that idea of regulation. You very rarely hear me say that about federal oversight, but yeah.
It creates an even playing field, I think, what I'm hearing from you. Talking with Alex Mutz, hemp farmer in Adams, Wisconsin, looking at hemp production in our state and where it goes from here. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Alex, last year, UW-Stevens Point started researching hemp's capacity to remove toxins like heavy metals, lead, arsenic from the soil. What is your crop primarily used for?
So we just originally we were partnered with and we still are partnered with a company that their main focus is creating a replacement for softwood in the pulping industries for, you know, for paper books, printed books, you know, trying to show that a paper mill or a forestry company or, you know, there's a lot of paper mills within a 100-mile radius of here that really just aren't in action, trying to use those infrastructures that have already been built by using a bit of a replacement to softwood would create a product of paper that, you know, was sustainably grown and absolutely plays a role in carbon sequestration. And so there's that company. So that's some of what we do. Part of our crop is grown for the purposes of me trying to find out where these markets are heading. So I have my own inventory for my company, and we just purchased a decortication system that will allow us and farmers around us to process their hemp here in the state of Wisconsin. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're the only ones that have the capability to separate the woody material from the fiber here in the state. And we just brought that here as of 2 weeks ago. So we're setting it up right now.
Alex, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Alex Mutz is a hemp farmer in Adams, Wisconsin, president of Complete Agronomy. That's a crop consulting firm. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.